You're listening to another great Torah class, recorded by TorahAnytime.com.
Just first of all, thank you very much for this chance to come to Toronto and work like a slave. I was asked to say something about marriage, Jewish marriage, and try to find some elements of sense and common sense in an insane world. The insanity of the world around us, no question it's affecting marriage, just like it's affecting all other aspects of our lives. So let's see if we can try to think through the subject and get some clarity. What I'd like to do, with your permission, is take a look, use as a framework for this subject, the question of choosing a suitable marriage partner. Right? How do you choose the correct victim partner? First of all, how many people here are married already? Right, well, it's too late for you. But since if you're married already, you're going to probably will be interfering with your children when they make their choices, you might as well interfere correctly. So let's take a look at the principles of choosing a marriage partner, and along the way we'll discuss some of the principles behind marriage and elements of Jewish marriage and some of the deeper elements as well if we can. But I'm doing this particularly because many of us are still looking for a marriage partner and need the criteria. Many of us will have the privilege of having to help our children get married. We'll need to understand that. And many people in the audience tonight are working with other people who need to get married as shadchanim, people who counsel people getting married, people who counsel people before marriage, early stages of marriage. And a lot of mistakes, I think, are being made in that field as well. So let me share with you some Torah thoughts and some experience in this field, if I may. Is that okay? Can we do that? I've seen more enthusiastic responses than that. Okay. I think that when you set out to choose a marriage partner, what makes sense is to make a list of necessary criteria. And I think the way to do it is to draw a red line and put above the red line the non-negotiables. And I think there are two non-negotiable criteria. Choosing someone to marry, I think there are two things that need to be there. Below the red line, a lot of negotiables. Negotiable does not mean not important. They may be critical. But they're not universally important. For some people they may be, for others they may not be. For example, let's say health. Do you need to marry somebody who's healthy? That's a personal question. I used to live in a certain place where I saw a young couple married, and every day I saw the young lady being taken off for medical treatment. 2 years later, she died. I went to see the young man, and he told me that when he met her 4 years before, she told him she had terminal cancer. He decided to marry her anyway. It was the most wonderful 4 years of his life. Not everybody could do that, right? Somebody strong enough to handle that and to do it, that's fine. So not everybody could. There are other negotiables. The young lady's mother, for example. Now, you know, some young ladies come with mothers who are nice. And others, you know, need a place to park their broom when they... So, you know, you get different types. Some young men will say, you know, I have to marry into a family that's warm and loving. Others will say, you know, the mother-in-law is irrelevant. I'll live in Alaska. We won't have a phone. You know, it'll be okay. So there are many negotiable items. And again, do not make the mistake of thinking these are not important. They could be critically important. But there are two things that if you're missing, you're almost guaranteed to be in big trouble. And by the way, when I say two non-negotiables above the red line, I'm assuming that we understand that above those are absolute requirements. Not just not negotiable, but absolute. Young man setting out to get married, the person he's thinking of marrying should be female. Right? Female. Well, you know, that needs to be said in this world. Talk about an insane world. She needs to be female. She also needs to be Jewish. Not because you can't have a wonderful relationship with a non-Jew. Of course you can. Why not? But Jewish marriage, what we call kiddushin, why can you not marry a non-Jew? The reason is because the concept we have of marriage that we call kiddushin is the reconstitution of an original spiritual oneness. These are two parts of the same original soul. This soul that is a fragment, what we call Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish composite soul, if you like, that was manifest, that was created originally as male and female components and taken apart in the spiritual world. You know, if we're allowed to mention a little bit of Kabbalah, Rabbi Karl Funkel, can we do that? If you look into the Kabbalistic tradition, you see that husband and wife in the spiritual world before they're brought down to this world are fused at the back. According to Kabbalah, there's a fusion at the back, only two fronts. There's no back. This means that husband and wife are one spiritual being. The beauty of that is one being, complete oneness, and no vulnerable side. According to Kabbalah, the back is the side of darkness, excretion, otherness, foreignness, unrecognizability, the dangerous side. In fact, there are even Kabbalistic descriptions of husband and wife back to back in the spiritual world as two street fighters attacked by a group of thugs in a dark alley. What do they do instinctively? They stand back to back to defend each other's weak side. So the weak side is being defended, so to speak. But the problem with that relationship is they cannot see each other. There's no meaningful relationship. And then a spiritual process called the Nesira, this is a detailed discussion in Kabbalah, they split and they're brought down to the world as two separate individuals, each with a vulnerable side, a wound, if you like, an open wound, where there was once the other attached, and then the mitzvah, the work is, of course, to fuse back into oneness, but this time identifying each other through the work of that relationship. And therefore, looking for a marriage partner is really looking not for someone you will get on necessarily well with, of course that's important, but you're looking really for the other half of your original personality. The Talmud says the reason a man longs to get married is because he's longing for the part that he's lost. In fact, you couldn't long for something unless you knew what it was. You can't miss something. You cannot long achingly for something unless you know what it means to you. And you only know what it means because it's part of your original nesham. By the way, all of life is like that. The Talmud says, the Gemara says that a child before birth is taught the whole Torah. An angel teaches a child the whole Torah in the womb, and just before birth he gives him a cruel blow, and the child forgets the whole Torah, all of spiritual wisdom that he knew. And he's born as a simple child who knows nothing. Why would Hashem, why would God see to it that a child is taught the whole Torah only to make him forget when he needs it? Because you search for it for the rest of your life. You know it's just out of reach. When you learn something spiritually true, you don't have a sense of learning, you have a sense of recognition. I know that's right. And the reason you know it right, because it was once part of your consciousness. And just out of that consciousness is all the wisdom you will need. And it's the striving for what was once part of the self. And therefore marriage, you cannot marry a non-Jew, not because you can't have a wonderful relationship with a non-Jew, but because it by definition cannot be. I'm not talking about a convert to Judaism. A convert is 1,000% Jewish. Many of the greatest figures in Jewish history have been converts. The Zohar says people converted to Judaism are lost souls, finding their way back in. So that's of course valid. But we're talking about a reconstitution of an original heart. You know, a very beautiful way to say this, exceptionally beautiful way to say this, is if you think about that original archetypal marriage, the original Jewish marriage, Abraham and Sarah, Avraham and Sarah, as they cross the border from Israel into Egypt, which really spiritually represents the border between the spiritual, the world of spiritual purity, and the world of marital impurity. Egypt was the most depraved land on earth, tremendously immoral in the sensual marital area. So as this holy Jewish couple, they cross the border from the world of spiritual purity into the world of spiritual danger, where marriage is tremendously threatened by the depravity of the culture, he turns to his wife and he says, "Please tell them you're my sister." What does that mean? The simple meaning is because if they thought that he was her husband, they would kill her. The Torah is never talking simple strategy. It's always talking on a much deeper level. And the secret here is that every man should think of his wife as his sister. What are brothers and sisters? Brothers, sisters, brother and sister are two separate individuals who share a common origin. That's exactly what husband and wife are. They have the same parents and they're born into the world as two separate people. But they share the bond, the secret bond of being coming from the original source. The word ach in Hebrew, which means a brother or a sister, means to restitch something that was once whole and then torn. You take a garment and tear it. When you restitch that together in Hebrew, that's called la'acher, ichui, to stitch together a tear. Brothers are people who are restitched. That means they have this bond between themselves because they were once one. And every man should think of his wife as the sister. If you think about this for a moment, you'll realize that the original archetypal marriage in the world was only brother marrying sister. When there were only two human beings, Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, and they had children, who married? Brothers and sisters. The Torah calls this Olam Chesed Yibone. That was the most wonderful form of marriage. You're talking about people from the same origin, reconstituting that oneness again. Today we cannot do that in a fallen world, important reasons for that. But this is the concept of marriage, is a looking for the other half of one's own. And this is what we mean by Beshit. Bashir doesn't mean destined. We don't believe in destiny. Destiny means it's inevitable. Destiny is a notion from Greek drama, where Oedipus is destined to marry his mother and kill his father no matter what he does. We don't believe in destiny. If destiny were true, you wouldn't have to make any effort. Walk out into the street, grab the first thing in a skirt. Well, that doesn't show much these days, but, you know, and marry her. It must be right. Bashir doesn't mean destined. Bashir means that there's somebody who is the perfect partner for you. If you make the effort, she'll be given to you, or he. By the way, there's no guarantee it will be a peaceful relationship. It could be terrible. But this is the person designed to bring out the best in you. It was one of the Talmudic rabbis had a wife who was too awful for words. And the student said, Rabbi, why didn't you divorce her? He said, I wouldn't give her the pleasure. The peace in the relationship, that's up to your work. But Bashirt, and therefore this concept of Bashirt is not practically relevant. A girl doesn't come with a sign flashing on her forehead saying she's your Bashirt. And therefore, it is a notion, do you ever know the person you married is your Bashirt? After 30 years of giving to this person in a completely unselfish fashion, you find an identity and a bond, you might know that. But it doesn't really affect anything practically. But we know that very deeply, this is a search for the lost other. If you're talking about absolute criteria, I don't want to spend the whole evening on this, but there are one or two others as well. For example, let's say a young man setting out to get married, the girl whom he's thinking of marrying should be able to have children. If a girl knows she cannot have children, there's an issue. Because a man's mitzvah is to have a child, to have children. We rule that you need to have two children at least a boy and a girl. Of course, there's a mitzvah to have every child you're given. But that's the basic. And therefore, since a man has a mitzvah to marry and have children, if a young lady knows she cannot have children, there's an issue. What do you do in such circumstances? It's a complicated discussion. A young girl came to see me some time ago. She told me, I was born without ovaries. I have a uterus, that means I could carry a pregnancy, but I cannot conceive a pregnancy. Right? She's been given hormones ever since she was a young girl. She looks beautiful, looks fully mature. I want to marry and have a Jewish home. But may I tell a young man that we'll take an egg from another woman, he'll fertilize the egg, that will be implanted into my womb, and I'll carry the pregnancy. Because if you say yes, I have a chance of getting married. But if you tell me no, who's going to marry me? Tragic question, because it's not simple halachically. I'm not going into the definitive halachic rulings here, but there's a very problematic situation. When an egg is taken from a donor and another woman carries the pregnancy, first question is, who's the mother? In Israel today, they register both women as the mother. Secular Israel today, the Knesset has taken the position that we legally register the egg donor and the gestational mother, the one who has the pregnancy. They're both, you know why? Because in Israel today, it's illegal, as it is in many countries, to marry a sibling. Well, if you register both mothers as the mother, it becomes automatically illegal to marry brothers or sisters on both sides, which is an excellent halachic solution. So one serious problem is, who is the mother? And there are many other questions as well. I'm not saying it's forbidden. There are certainly halachic authorities who allow it. But I told this young lady that probably a better option for her would be if she could find a young man who cannot have children. Or a very amazing option is if she can find a young man who has married and has children already. He's fulfilled the mitzvah of having children, but his wife has died. The Talmud says that if a man's wife dies and there are little children, he may remarry in the first week of mourning for his late wife. He can't live with her intimately, he's a mourner. But why should the children be motherless? And therefore she has the opportunity to fulfill enter a situation of becoming a mother to children who already exist and don't have a mother, which is what she set out to do. Anyway, these are things, by the way. Why is it a man's mitzvah to have children? Why is it a man's mitzvah to marry and not a woman's? A woman has no obligation. A woman has no obligation to get married. If she chooses to do some hapless male a favor and put up with his, you know, male issues and bear children for him, if she marries, she cannot refuse to have children. She can't say, you know, it'll affect my figure. If she's going to get married, she has to agree, but she doesn't have to get married in the first place. Why does the Torah give a mitzvah to men to marry and not to women? Well, fascinating question. Once, some time ago, a young lady, very, very amazing and talented, very beautiful, special young lady, the fact that she's my daughter is completely irrelevant. She said to me one day, she said, Abba, I would like to ask your Rebbe a question. So fine. Next time we had the opportunity, we went to see him, and she said, I have two questions for you. These were her two questions. Question one, why do I not have a commandment to get married? If Hashem wants me to get married, he'll tell me. And I want to do what he wants me to do. And if he wants me to get married, he'll tell me and I'll get married. But he hasn't told me to get married. There's no commandment for me. Evidently, he doesn't really, not really concerned. Question one. Question two. Why was Eve cursed in an area that's optional? When Eve sinned, she was cursed with difficulty in pregnancy and pain in childbirth. And you expect the curse to be something affecting her essence. This is the beginning of humankind's path through history. You expect she's done something that offends her essence, and the curse will be in her essence. Why was she cursed? God is saying to a woman, you'd have difficulty in pregnancy and pain in childbirth, but just don't do it if you don't want to. Well, what kind of curse is that? Good question. No? He said, both your questions are answered with the same answer. Listen to this amazing answer. He said, the principle that answers your questions is as follows. Mitzvahs are only given in areas of your deficiency. You are only commanded in things that you lack, things that you don't want to do. Who wants to give their money away to other people? Torah says, do it. Who wants to curb their sensual appetites? The Torah says, curb them. The mitzvahs are always corrections for problems. The Zohar calls mitzvahs etzes, strategies to overcome your deficiencies. So the principle is you're only given mitzvahs where you need them because you're deficient. The classic and obvious example is that women are exempt from mitzvahs that are time-bound. Positive mitzvahs that the time occasions, like tzitzis worn in the day, tefillin worn in the day, things that have a date attached to them, women are exempt. Why are women exempt from time-bound mitzvahs? There are simple explanations. A woman has a baby, the child needs her, you can't command her to do things when the child needs her. But again, the Torah is never simply practical. The deep reason is because women are not deficient in time cycle issues. Their bodies resonate with time. They don't need to be beaten into a time discipline. Do you know the ovarian cycle is a medical mystery? It's an absolute miracle. Do you know that all biological cycles that we know are attached to some physical phenomenon, day-night variation, seasonal change, temperature changes? The woman's ovary, it works through the seasons and through... The only thing the ovary is connected to is the cycles of the moon. And medicine has no idea how that works. Some women's cycle begin on the same date of the Hebrew month every month, whether it's a long month or a short month. The ovary knows what the moon's doing. Medicine doesn't even have a tool for measuring that. So women are locked into a cosmic time cycle. They don't need to be beaten into that, so they're exempt. And he said to her, and therefore you don't have a mitzvah to get married. Not because God doesn't want you to, but he doesn't need you to force you into it. The Torah credits women with understanding the meaning of a relationship and not having to beat them into it. Men need to be disciplined and beaten into it, and even then they... almost hopeless. But women understand the meaning of a marital relationship, and therefore he said, of course Eve was cursed in an area that's of her essence. You cannot take the lack of a commandment as a sign of that. And of course you should get married, not because you need to be forced into it, but because you ought to understand it. So there are absolute requirements. Let's assume those are in place. What are the two non-negotiable items that you need to seek when you are looking for someone to marry? What would you say is the first thing to look at? Money. Someone said money? Money? Yes, that's a good idea. Right? No, I don't think so. I think the first criterion, I think, is natural attraction. Natural attraction, chemistry. You know, it's a religious requirement. First of all, it's practical. Experience shows us that this is necessary. Marriage is difficult at the best of times. Natural chemistry, right? You need to have this, and it's a question of taste. It's not a question of logic. You can't analyze this. I like blue, you like pink. You know, it's a question of taste. But it's very important. The Gemara says that a man should see a woman before marrying her. Shouldn't contract a marriage with someone in Australia, you know, by proxy that you've never seen. Why? Because when you have to get together, and he looks at her, and maybe she has something offensive about her, and he will not be able to be close to her, he will not be able to fulfill the mitzvah. Love your neighbor as yourself, which applies to your wife as well. And therefore, you need to see each other. Does the woman need to see the man? Not so important. Not so important. The Gemara says that it's important. But women understand, as I said, the quality of a relationship much more than men. And they'll put up with less, or more or less. I don't know what it is. But they can get by in a relationship, investing in the meaningful aspect of the relationship. They don't get stuck at the superficial as easily as men do. But it is important in both directions. It is important. A woman also needs to feel that. Late one Saturday night, I had a knock at my door. It's a young lady standing there, pale, drawn, shaking. She has to speak to me. We sit down. She tells me she's getting married in 8 days' time. Tomorrow a week is her wedding. What's the problem? She greatly admires the young man she's engaged to, but she finds him a little physically offensive. Why did you get engaged to him? I think he's wonderful. I admire him greatly. But now that it's getting closer, I'm having to think about being physically close to him. I'm not sure I can. I said to her, you think about it now and make a decision now. You either decide you're going through with this and you never look back, or you call it off now. She sat there agonizing over the question for a long time, made the decision to get married. They got married. They got divorced on their wedding night. She couldn't go home with him. And that's where the marriage ended. Not good. So this is a very important, and men can be ridiculous. My wife and I dealt with a young man, young couple, they got married. And about 3 weeks after the wedding, the young man walks into my office and he says he's having terrible trouble being married to this girl. He just cannot be close to her. I said, what's wrong with her? She does not look like my mother. I said, what? She doesn't look like my mother. I said, why did you marry her? My rabbi said it would be okay. That is not good. He used to come and see me and cry every week, and 6 months later they got divorced. She was a beautiful girl, by the way. Not good. Now, this raises another point. And that is, if you counsel young people, if you're a shatkan, you work with people, or it's your child, you must never tell somebody it will be okay. They must take responsibility. When you push a young person into marriage and you take the responsibility, you'll get the call at 3 o'clock in the morning where things are not okay and they didn't choose to be there. They're not invested in it because they're not committed. That's a disastrous strategy. You counsel, you crystallize, you clarify issues, you can advise, but to tell a person, don't worry, it'll be okay, when they've not made that commitment, classically what happens is they get engaged, the next morning they wake up in an absolute cold sweat, the date is set, things have been paid for, and as each day goes by, the terror mounts, and then everybody has a, you know, complete breakdown. That is not the way to do it. Sometimes, yes, you can use your judgment. We had a young man in England a few years ago who was engaged, and it was very clear to him that she was the right girl. There was no question about that. But he was feeling a little terrified. You know, he was a single child. He lived with his mother only. And 3 weeks before the wedding, he started lying in bed crying in the fetal position. You know, and we couldn't get him out of bed, and he just cried for 3 weeks. We carried him to the chuppah in the fetal position. Me and Rabbi Kirsch, we held him up. We stood under the chuppah holding him up while he was curled up and crying. Anyway, you know, he's got 5 children now. They're happily married. You know, in such a case, yes, you can push someone into it. But if it's not that clear, they must make the decision themselves. Now, how attractive does this person have to be? Do you have to look at them and get life-threatening asthma? You know? I would say at least mild breathlessness, you know, a little breathless. I would say that in this area there's a red line. They need to be above the red line. Below the red line you find offensive, you couldn't be close to them. Above the red line, they're attractive. How much above the red line? Not so important. Life changes you, age changes you, pregnancy changes you. But above the red line, there should be a chemistry, not just a physical attraction. You don't spend half an hour together without speaking and feel comfortable. This is a very, very important aspect of a relationship. And I put it first because I think it's easiest to assess. I'm not saying it's the most important thing. But after you've met a person a few times, not the first time, a person's beauty grows on you. But after you've met 4 or 5 times and you're just not feeling any ability to connect, then it is that's a warning sign. If you're spiritually great enough and mature enough, then fine, you could marry anyone. Of Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, for example. When he was a young man, a young lady was suggested, and he agreed. When the time came to marry her, it turned out she was 10 years older than they told him, and she probably could not have children. But he married her because he wouldn't hurt her feelings. He had agreed. As it happens, 10 years later she died, he married someone else, he had children. But not many people could go through that. Actually, in New York some time ago, a couple of years ago in New York, there was a wedding where the groom never appeared. He chickened out. On the day of the wedding, the bride was there, and he just didn't arrive. As soon as it became apparent that he wasn't going to be there, without a moment's hesitation, his brother, who was present, stepped under the chuppah and married her. She shouldn't be embarrassed. Yeah? Look, maybe he liked her. I don't know. But, you know, the point is that if you're a big enough person, yes, you could marry anyone. But for most of us, and particularly people who have a secular background, this is a very important thing to know, that in the so-called Baal Tshuva world, people who were brought up, you know, people who were brought up not religious, just brought up normal, there are issues in the Baal Tshuva world. People who've had many intimate relationships, who have guilt issues, and have now changed their life course. This is a difficult area. Very often the mistake is made, they marry for spiritual criteria, and they explicitly exclude the physical and the sensual because they think it's their guilt issues and issues with it. One young man asked me, a friend of mine, when we were in yeshiva, could you please speak to me about the girl that he's dating? I said, yes, yeah. He started telling me, she's so spiritual, the way she says to heal him, she's such a religious, she could be Mrs. Mashiach. You know, she was just absolutely... After he told me all about this young girl's spiritual qualities, I said to him, do you like her? And he said, no. I said, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? He was so religious, he wanted to exclude this. One young man came to see me recently. He said to me, I'm getting married in 3 weeks' time and I'm a little anxious. Why? Because I've had many intimate relationships before. In fact, 138. And he's been counting. I'm concerned, will my wife live up to my expectations? You know, it's a problem. It's a problem. If you grow up in a world where that's not an issue, if you grow up in the ultra, let's call it ultra-Orthodox world, we have no contact with the opposite sex. And anyway, the girl's going to shave her head and wear thick bulletproof stockings, you know, from the day she gets married. You know, there won't be an issue. You know? I know a young man. I know a man who's... Many years ago, was a young man. He was brought up in Meir Shearim in Jerusalem. And he told us how he got married. I'm telling you this out of sociological interest. This is not for you. Okay, this is not for us. This is just out of, you know, historical interest. He was brought up in the ultra-Orthodox, let's call it, world in Meir Shearim. When he was 18 years old, his father walked in one day and said, Nochem, put on your Shabbos clothes. He said, why? He said, never mind. So he got dressed in his Shabbos outfit. And his father walked him from Meir Shearim into a house in Gula. And his father said, say hello to your kala. So he said, hello. And everyone said, Mazel Tov. The men had a party in one room. The women had a party in another room. On the way out, his father said, say goodbye to your kala. He said, no, not her. He said, goodbye. And the next time they met was under the chuppah. You know, they met. They agreed. As it happens, after the marriage, they were married for quite a while, unable to have children. And they went to see the Chazon Ish, great rabbinic figure in Bnei Brak. And he gave them a blessing, a bracha for Chai Bonim Chaim. He blessed them that they should have 18 living children. And some years ago, they had their 19th. Okay, that's not for you. I mean, 19 children is for you. I give you all a bracha, you should have 19 children. No question. But not a one-time meeting if you come from a secular background. By the way, last week, I had the wonderful opportunity to meet someone. Unfortunately, it was a shiva occasion. But the man who had died, the father, my friend, his father was one of 23 children. 23 children. What happened was there were 21 girl and 21 boys. One mother, one girl, 20. When the girl grew up and got married, she was unable to have children. So she went to her mother and said, Imma, you have 21 boys. Give me one to raise. Mother said, fine, you take one, I'll make another one. So the mother went on to have a 23rd, and she raised one of her brothers as her own child, right? That's it, what people can do. Anyway, the point is that he's never met his cousins, by the way. He has no idea where they are. You know, it's too many. The point is that there needs to be an attraction, and it needs to be, I think that's a sensible place to begin. What's the most important second non-negotiable? The person's attractive, and you could feel you could be close to them. There's a natural chemistry. What's the second non-negotiable? What would you say?
Love.
Love. That's very nice and romantic. Now, I think the second criterion is the raw human material. Call it personality, call it midas, whatever you want to say. Who's the person? You know, many young people say to me, you know, I have to marry somebody who's very intelligent. I don't think that's important. I don't think that's important. I will show you people with two PhDs whose personal lives are in a shambles. And I'll show you people who have no academic skills, who have wisdom in their hands. They know how to conduct relationships. I don't think academic qualifications, you know, some girls tell me I have to marry somebody who's very intelligent. I say, why? So we can have D&Ms, like my daughters tell me, deep and meaningfuls, you know, deep and meaningful. Who, you know, from the day you get married, you will never have another deep and meaningful discussion. You know, who's got time? You know, I mean, while you're dating, enjoy it. Wonderful. You can sit up all night and have deeper meaningful. So if you get married, what are you going to talk to your wife about? The Southeast Asian political problem? You know, first of all, you know what she thinks about it. You know, she doesn't agree with you anyway. And therefore, you know, halafai, we have enough time to talk about the practicalities. In many marriages, people are so busy, they pass like ships in the night. And therefore, academic intelligence, I don't think so. You need to respect the person and look up to them intelligent. Fine, if that's your issue, it's your issue. But there's no substitute for the personality, for the person themselves. Ideally, you are looking for somebody who is kind, loving, affectionate, giving, coping, unhung up. A normal South African, that would be a good that would be a good way to say it. If you choose somebody who's psychopathic, twisted, hung up, depressed, miserable, and you know, you're in trouble. Unless you're psychopathic, twisted, and hung up, then you'll be... Do you know about the sadist and the masochist who got married? A sadist and a masochist got married, right? Well, perfect. When the door closed, they were alone together for the first time. The masochist said to the sadist, "Hurt me." And the sadist said, "No." Okay. Anyway, so... there's no substitute for the person. At 3 a.m. when money's tight and you're in pain and things are not going well, what comes through is the basic personality. Now, many people have issues and baggage. That's fine. Okay, so can you cope with that? Do the issues fit? But you cannot afford to think about the person's taste in music and whether they like Italian food and whether they... And I looked at the basic personality. Compatibility of taste is not so important. Not so important. The best marriage I ever saw was between two totally dissimilar individuals. Totally dissimilar. The man was the most absolutely logical engineer. And my mother-in-law, I mean the woman, is completely autistic and emotional. Right? But the most marvelous marriage, total respect, wouldn't dream of interfering with each other's areas. Bedroom door closed, the children knew it's the private zone, and the children knew the parents come for each other first, they're king and queen. The children in that marriage tell me they never saw a personal argument ever. Ever. Personal. I don't mean you can have a violent argument with your wife about an issue, why not? But personal, absolutely never. You may never insult your spouse. Never. Ridiculous. How can you do this? Most important person in the world. Our sages say that a woman can take insults from a husband much better than a man can, but not in front of other people. When he disrespects her in front of others, terrible pain. And the punishment for making your wife cry, it's too awful to even think about. I'm not even going to tell you what it is. And therefore, never a personal criticism. Absolutely out the question. And you never go to bed at night without at least a chilly good night. You know, no silent treatment. You can sit there with matchsticks in your eyes until you can at least get the words out. Then you can go to sleep. Absolutely not. How do you criticize when you need to? What happens if you need to criticize? Man comes home from work, starving, hasn't eaten since Tuesday. You know, and she forgot to make dinner. She forgot. It happens. So she's warmed up some lukewarm cabbage from Shabbos 2 weeks before, forgetting that he's allergic to cabbage. You know. So what happens? In most marriages, the cabbage ends up all over the ceiling. But, a Jewish husband, eat all the cabbage. Absolutely. She made it. You eat it. No question. Then you have to say something. You know, she might do it again. Nobody could take that. So you wait a couple of days till she makes your favorite dinner. Then you say, "No, you know what, darling? This is even better than cabbage." And she gets the message. Get the message across in a loving way. Right? That's the way you have to do it. Do you know you should not ask your spouse to do you a favor unless you know they consider it an act of love? You should not ask your wife to take your dry cleaner to the dryer. She's not your slave. Absolutely not. Unless you know she considers it a privilege and an act of love. Imagine the president came to see you. And as he's leaving, you know, with the TV and the bodyguards and the entourage, as he leaves your house, you say, "Mr. President, I know you're going past the shoemaker. Could you please take my shoes?" Why not? It's too important. Your wife's more important. By the way, this is enshrined in Jewish law. We have a law called Shana Rishona, the law of the first year of marriage. This law assumes that men take their wives for granted and that women never take their husbands for granted. In fact, our rabbis said that even when a woman starts dressing provocatively for other men to notice, it's not because she wants other men to notice, it's because she wants her thick, dense, obtuse husband to remember that she's attractive because he takes her for granted. If you walk up to a man on the street and ask him if he loves his wife, absolutely, he'll buy flowers. But he wasn't thinking about it just then. He was thinking about his next $1 million, his next page of Gemara, his next sports achievement. So men need to be disciplined into a year of doing nothing other than proving to his wife that she's the most important thing in the world. The Torah says that if he's the chief of staff of the army and it needs him, nothing doing. He stays home. And many modern rabbinic authorities say it now takes us 10 years, and some say it never ends. And therefore, you do nothing without her permission, and you show her. You're in the middle of a board meeting, millions of dollars about to change hands. You're in charge. At the most critical moment, there's a phone call. Who's on the line? The wife. What's the normal response? I'll call back. Nothing doing. Jewish husband. You take the phone, you say, gentlemen, you can all wait, it's my wife. And you have to say it loudly so she hears, then she'll stop phoning in the middle of the day. And therefore, this is the relationship of absolute and ultimate respect. And that's the way it has to be dealt with. So, in summary, we have found a person who's attractive. We found a person who's a good... By the way, how do you know they're a good, kind person? How do you get to know the personality? Well, there are a few tools you can use. One is a little bit of history. What is the person's history? Do they have long-standing, loyal friendships? What has been their background and history? What's the family like? The family is very important. A lot of sociological and psychological and psychiatric research has shown time and again that people repeat the patterns of their families. In abusive families, the abuse continues, unfortunately. There are many exceptions. The Balchiva world is one exception. It has its own issues and different issues. But that is a pattern, and therefore, what are the family relationships? Go and visit the home. Walk into the house. If there's soft music playing and loving relationships and everything's fine, that's good. But if there's blood on the walls and human bones stacked in, that doesn't bode well, you know. By the way, a pattern we see time and again is a Baal Tshuva, somebody from a fractured and very angry and painful background, who becomes newly religious. Very often we see that they switch from looking at their parents with bitterness and anger to looking at them with pity. If only my parents had had a more authentic Jewish education, they never would have got into those problems. And then classically they model themselves on a religious family that they admire and reconstruct in a very interesting way. That happens quite often. But these things are very important. And secondly, I would say, enough time. Enough time. If you're going to date three times for 3 weeks and the religious world starts putting pressure on, that's not good. You need enough time to get to know the person comfortably so when you make a commitment, you know you're not going to turn back. How much time does this take? I'll give you a rule of thumb. Thanks. I'll give you a rule of thumb. Until no new information is coming. When you know one more date is not going to change your attitude, your impression, your knowledge of how they respond and how they react, that's the time to split or commit. Just making it more difficult as time goes by. But if not yet reached that moment, you don't understand them fully, you can't afford to get married and then decide you want 25 children and discover she wants to be sterilized. You know, that's not good. Happened to a friend of mine. Married a girl in California, and then she told him she'd been sterilized. She had one child, and can you imagine a doctor doing that to her? As it happens, 3 weeks later she left him. She went to discover herself in the hills of California. That's fine. So you went to find herself. You married someone else. So you need to get to a point where you know the person. If I said to you, if I gave you a scenario, and I asked you what a member of your family, how he would respond in that situation, you would know. You know the person. When you get to know somebody like that, that is the time when you know them well enough to make a decision. And continuing the problem is not going to help. By the way, it pays to see them under a little bit of stress as well. Get your little sister to spill hot soup in his lap. Slam the door on his fingers. Get the dog to bite him a couple of times. You know, put him through a little bit of stress and see what the responses are. You know, it's very useful. Very useful. So once you've gotten to know the person and the personality, you've gotten a good feel of who the person is, that is the time to make a commitment. And finally, I've gone over time. I'll just say that below the red line, of course, there are many, many negotiables. And we have seen classic issues. A very unimportant issue, as I said, is compatibility, as long as there's mutual respect. Money, by the way, needs to be organized clearly. The Talmud says when money problems arise, love leaves. And the reason is because in other areas, we have a very beautiful default captaincy in Judaism. Who's the final authority when consensus cannot be reached? You cannot have two captains of a ship. So our law is, Jewish law is, that in all religious matters, the husband makes the final decision, except the woman's religious issues. For example, marital intimacy, the laws that go around that, kashrut in the kitchen, she has total authority and he must trust her totally. But any other halachic technical areas, the man should be the knowledgeable one. Any practical matters, she's the final authority. If you marry a girl who wants purple walls with yellow spots, you love it. You love it. You have no say when it comes to the practical. That's her area. And therefore, you have split captaincy, and once you have defined, delegated, designated leadership, you have no conflict. Money needs to be organized. You have a common account, and she overspends every month, tension arises, not good. So either you say nothing, or you have separate accounts. The Chofetz Chaim says you should have a Shalom Bayis fund. Put aside money every month, so you have a wife who leaves the lights on always, and you keep telling her, put off the lights, I'm paying the electricity bills. She's not going to change, I promise you, she's not going to change. Have $100 a month that you put away, so you'll pay for it. It's worth it for the peace in your marriage. Even small things can be potentially absolutely ruinous. I know a marriage where the husband is very, very organized. And my wife, you know, I am very organized. I was trained surgically. I need to know if I put an instrument down during surgery, I reach out, it'll be there. I put my keys in the same way always. If there's a fire in the house, I know where the keys are. My wife, bless her, never puts anything in the same place twice. Never. She has very creative places to put things. Right? That can ruin a marriage in a week. But I have a solution. I have my own stuff. I don't tell her where it is. I've got my own keys. I've got all the important stuff. I've got my own. You know, I would never survive otherwise. You know, if my phone book isn't like totally alphabetical, I can't sleep at night. And hers is like very interesting. You know, it's very creative the way she files it. Right? She's an artist, you know. So these are things that could do. And finally, we've seen cultural issues that are problems. Classically, a young man from the Midwest, for example, or from South Africa or Australia, marrying a very privileged girl from New York society, who's got very feminist ideas about the world, it can be very tense. An American boy marrying a South American woman or a European woman often works very well. French and Spanish and South American women have a very natural sense of their femininity. They don't come into conflict with the male ego. There are many cultural issues. A South African or an American young man marrying a girl from a secular Israeli background. How do you handle a girl who's very assertive and has a submachine gun? You know. I mean, you know, that very carefully. You know. So if you're looking for the submissive feminine, you know, and you're dealing with somebody very aggressively assertive, these are issues. These are issues. They often come up after the marriage. So in summary, we're talking here about the holiest of all relationships. These are some suggestions about practicality. Male and female represent opposite spiritual poles in the world. The Ramban makes it clear that the togetherness in marriage is nothing more, nothing less than the learning ground for the beginning of a spiritual relationship. There's no accident that we are regarded as the bride and God, Hashem, as the groom. We're moving now towards Shavuot, is the time of the marriage, as it's called. The Ramban says that marriage and marital intimacy is the learning ground for the holiest of relationships. You have it in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. Today, that's a difficult area. Today, we're happy if people are just more or less normal. But the point is that marriage, with all its aspects, is the ultimate learning ground for personal development and for spiritual growth. And therefore, with these practical steps and a vision of marriage, a vision of the goal, we should be able to transform the merely material into the transcendent. Thank you.
You're listening to another great Torah class, recorded by TorahAnytime.com.